called me this week. He's listened to my sermon from last week. He said, I want you to do it again and get it right this time. So we're going to start all over the genealogy. No, I'm just kidding. I would never preach on a genealogy 2 weeks in a row. So I know better than that. Yeah, thanks, awesome. we are going to look at the same passage again, Matthew, but chapter 2. We're going to start in chapter 2 this week. So if you'd open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 2. I also learned from Brian that the best way to make your sermons last long enough is to repeat the last sermon and all the sermons in the series so far over and over and over again. So this sermon will probably be twice as long. As you're opening to Matthew 2, I do want to quickly review. We're going to build on last week, so I'm going to get some of the important parts. You missed all the jokes about you. Oh, good. We were talking last week. We started with the genealogy, if you remember. Main point of the genealogy, Matthew's trying to communicate that Jesus is the Davidic king. He's the rightful heir to the throne of David, which makes him the Messiah. As we see from the prophecies, especially in 2 Samuel, where we have the Davidic covenant, this is where it's talking about a ruler will come from David's throne and his house will reign forever. And Jesus is the fulfillment of this. And Matthew is trying to communicate to his Jewish readers that Jesus is the rightful heir to the Davidic throne. So he traces all the way, starting with Abraham, Jesus' line, through the house of David, all the way through all the kings. When you read through the list, it's just like the list that are in Chronicles. And you can see that Jesus is the rightful heir to the throne of David. That's the first point that he's making here with the genealogy. There's another point he's making, which we talked about for a while. There are some people that are included in the genealogy, which you would not expect. On four different occasions through the genealogy, Matthew includes women. And this is not the normal custom for tracing a royal lineage, especially for the Jews. And Matthew includes these four women for a specific reason, at least for two specific reasons, actually. The first, I think, is to set up the what's coming with Mary. Mary is not married to Joseph yet, and she's found to be with child. And so there's this essentially a scandal going on. Joseph's going to divorce her privately, but an angel comes to him and explains what's going on. And so he goes ahead and takes her as his wife. To the whole community, this probably looks like, Joseph and Mary had a child before they actually got married. That's what it's going to look like to everybody else. But Mary and Joseph both know the truth, even if no one else does. What Matthew does here is he includes four women in the genealogy who all had similar scandals in their lives. So Bathsheba and Ruth and Rahab and Tamar. Most of these women were accused of prostitution or something of the like. And Matthew's showing that the genealogy of Jesus, it might be what you expect, and that it's a royal genealogy. Jesus is the rightful heir to the throne of David. But there's also some things along the way, some people along the way who you might not expect, these people that were involved in these scandals, these women. And I think it's to set up this idea of Mary, to probably all the Jewish readers, they're probably having a hard time believing the virgin birth. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. That's not an easy thing to say, okay, oh yeah, Mary, that makes sense, that it was the Holy Spirit. This is what everyone's looking around and saying, but Matthew says, look at the Davidic line. Look at the line where Jesus came from. God works through all kinds of ways, in all kinds of amazing ways. You think about somebody like Rahab, who was a prostitute in Jericho, but she shelters the spies. And she brings them in and really becomes part of the the royal line of David because of her faithfulness to what God was calling her to do. So this is the first reason is to set up what's going on with Mary and to say, hey, it might not be what you expect. The second reason is also to demonstrate something that a Jew wouldn't expect, is that all four of these women were Gentiles. Now, Mary is not a Gentile, but this is showing that even the Gentiles are going to be included in this plan. There's something bigger going on here than just this Jewish king. There's a plan for the redemption of the world. And we can see this. Matthew's already hinting at the inclusion of the Gentiles with these four women that he includes in the genealogy. We talked about that for a while. And what we can really learn from this is no matter what you've done, you can be a part of God's plan. God calls us to be faithful to what he's, to what he's commanded us to do. We are to be faithful to him. But whatever's in our past, that doesn't exclude us from participating in God's plan. And this is what we can learn from these women in the genealogy. We move on. We talked about the Magi for a while, and we're going to talk about the Magi again today briefly. Just to review for everyone who the Magi are. They're these kings from the East, but they're probably more like astrologers slash priests slash kings. They're clearly very wealthy. They come with, these amazing gifts, very costly gifts. They travel a long way. They've been traveling for a long time, seemingly. And the Magi, it's odd because they come into the city of Jerusalem, and they're looking for the king, and they talk to Herod. And we talked for a while about the prophets. There's a prophecy in Numbers from Balaam, and it says, a star will rise out of Judah, and this star will be the king, and he's going to conquer all these other nations around. One of the nations that listed is Edom. Now, I don't know for sure that this is why the Magi, it doesn't say that the Magi knew this prophecy about the star, and so they went looking for the king. But there is in Numbers this prophecy that says a star will rise, and this is Jesus. He's the star that comes out of Judah, and he is the king. And I think the Magi maybe saw this star. They were aware of this prophecy because they're these astrologers. So any kind of religious material with a star or anything like this, they're like, sure, yeah, add it to our collection of astrology writings. So they've got this, and maybe they found it when the Jews were in captivity, and the Jews were kind of spread all over. Maybe somebody came and they got a copy of the Torah. I don't know for sure, but when they come to King Herod, Herod starts to panic. And in this prophecy in Numbers, it says that the king will destroy the Edomites. And just happens to be that Herod is an Edomite. So Herod says, I got to find this king, this baby, and I've got to kill him before he destroys me. And so we see that the Magi come, and Herod panics, and listen to what Herod says here. Actually, look here, Matthew chapter 2. We'll just start reading at the beginning. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi came from the east to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born the King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Now, I started to make this point last week, but listen, you find it odd that all of Jerusalem is disturbed with him? That King Herod is disturbed, and maybe because he's like, oh no, this guy's going to be out to get me. He's going to be out to get my throne, or he's going to conquer my people. But that all of Jerusalem is disturbed with him. Now, these are people who should be excited that the Messiah is coming. They're these people who their whole lives have been waiting for the Messiah, have been holding on to these prophecies and saying, when is the Messiah coming? When is he going to throw off the yoke of Rome? Or when is he going to restore the Davidic king? But when they hear that the Messiah has been born, Herod is disturbed and all of Jerusalem is disturbed with him. Now, we see from Herod's actions in this passage that Herod legitimately believes that this baby is the Messiah. Herod goes to the extent of killing all the babies in the surrounding area that are in a certain age range that, you know, he kind of estimates and says, well, he's probably about this old, so I'm not going to take any chances. I'm going to kill all the babies. Herod really believes that this is the Messiah. And I would imagine that the chief priests do too. When they're explaining this, they talk about Bethlehem and they say this is where it's going to happen. And Herod sends the Magi to go kind of check it out for him. Well, Herod really believes that this is the Messiah. And it's just so striking that all of Jerusalem is terrified and the Magi are coming to worship. The Magi are these pagan kings, astrologers, priests, but they get it. They get that Jesus is the king and he's worthy of worship. And the people in Jerusalem, they're terrified. It's just this contrast that even here, I think Matthew's trying to indicate, hey, this king is not just for the Jews. This king is for everyone. He's bringing redemption to the whole world. This theme of redemption and the inclusion of the Gentiles is an important part of Matthew. And I think maybe because his primary audience is Jewish when he's writing, and when he includes all these prophecies, he's trying to tell them the plan of redemption is for the whole world. And this Jesus brings salvation. Matthew actually quotes here farther down the passage in verse 18. He quotes from Jeremiah 31, which is the New Covenant. We talked about that. That this is the law will be written on their hearts, and there will be this new kind of kingdom. And maybe this is why the priests were worried, because they see the ushering in of this new system, and maybe they're worried their jobs are going away too. I don't know. It's so odd that that Jerusalem is disturbed along with Herod. So we see that Jesus comes to bring salvation. This is what Matthew's making a point. He's like, yes, he is the Davidic king, and I'm going to show you that. And I'm showing you all these prophecies of this is who Jesus is, and this is how they said he was coming. And we've been looking forward to this, and Jesus fulfills all these prophecies. And he says, and don't forget that Jesus came to save the whole world. So he includes these Gentiles in the genealogy. He includes this story about the Magi who are correctly honoring this baby. And he includes a passage here from the New Covenant in Jeremiah 31. And we see this is a plan of redemption unfolding. So as we look at this passage again, I have a few more things that I want to point out here. Matthew chapter 1, we have the genealogy, and if you remember, there's no real Christmas story here. Matthew says, this is what's going to happen. He gives the genealogy, and then he says, this is what's going to happen. Jesus is going to come, and you're going to give him this name. And the angels kind of explain everything to Joseph. And then, it's just like one sentence, and Jesus was born, and he named him Jesus. The baby was born, and Joseph named him Jesus. And that's the whole, like Luke spends a chapter on this whole event and talks about the shepherds and the manger and all this stuff. Matthew's not concerned with that. He says, and Jesus was born, and they gave him the right name. And then he moves on. Pick up here in chapter 2. We'll read this again. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, first point. We didn't get very far. First point. Matthew is, in this passage, he's really, really concerned with the places. And I think it's because there is this prophecy about Bethlehem. The Old Testament clearly states this is where the Messiah will be born. And so Matthew is explaining all these things that are going on. He talks about Bethlehem and Jerusalem and Egypt and Nazareth. But it's kind of he's going from place to place to place. He's kind of setting the scene. So let's pick up in verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. Now, I think the Magi come here, they go to Jerusalem because it's the capital. And where would a king be born? in the capital. So they come into the court of Herod probably, and they say, you know, where is this king? And Herod's like, can you explain that a little bit? What's, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. And so he gets the priests together. He's disturbed and all of Jerusalem with him. And so he calls together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, and he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. When you compare Bethlehem with Jerusalem, I mean, the Magi didn't just show up in Bethlehem. There's a reason they went to Jerusalem, because it's the capital. It's where the rulers are. It's the big city. You know, if you were going to come to the United States and you wanted to see the leader, you'd go to Washington, D.C., because that's the capital. That's where the leader lives. So the Magi are looking for the king, so they go to Jerusalem, this grand city, capital, up on top of a hill. But the city of Bethlehem is very different. It's this rural little town south of Jerusalem, and it's not the place you would expect a king to be born. You know, Luke gives us more detail about this, about the manger. I mean, that's really not what you would expect. But Matthew's saying, it's in this place, it's in Bethlehem, and he quotes this passage from Micah. And this passage is saying, but you, Bethlehem, and land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. You would assume when you look at Bethlehem that it is the least place. I mean, it's like Des Plaines or something. And, you know, nobody's coming. Nobody thinks the Messiah is going to be born in Des Plaines. So they get this prophecy and they go, it's not what you would expect. We see the birth of Christ is kind of the opposite. You would expect this grand, triumphant ruler to be born in Jerusalem, but he's born quietly in Bethlehem. Let's keep reading here. So then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out the exact time the star had appeared. You know, he's already kind of scheming here. He's saying, all right, I need to find out how old this baby is. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. I feel like we should put quotes around worship, you know, so that I too may go and worship him. After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child and his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. They opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So you see that the Magi kind of take off. They're warned in a dream. Let's not go back to Herod. They know what's going on, and so they go a different way. We have Bethlehem as the least. It's this, in comparison to Jerusalem, it's such a tiny, insignificant place. There's another word here that it's not so clear in English. The Magi are going and they find the child. It says the verse 9, the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. This word for child, there's a couple words in Greek for child, and you know, just like we have boy and kid and, you know, crazy child, and so we have all these things that we have different names for children, and they kind of all mean a little bit different. Some are more descriptive of like a specific age. Some are more, you know, just general that's a young person. You know, this word for child here specifically means, you know, a child who is helpless, who is a really young, maybe like a toddler or younger, a child who can't do anything on their own, who's dependent on their parents. The word in Greek actually has a special ending that makes it, it's called the diminutive. So it makes it, it's like a, almost like a pet name, like a, you know, my little child, my sweet baby or something like that. And this word's used almost 60 times in the New Testament, and 20 of those are here in Matthew. About 40% are here in Matthew. Out of all the times it's used in Matthew, half of them are in this chapter. This chapter is about the little child, the little helpless baby. Who is the king? Do you see what Matthew's doing here? There's this little tiny baby, this little child who is so precious, is so sweet, but he's also the king. And you compare that to Herod, who is this king who is ruthless, a dictator almost, and you have this sweet little baby who the Magi come and worship. I just found it interesting that as he's talking about Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Herod and the baby, the Bethlehem is not the least. It's this tiny place, but it's so important because this is where the Messiah comes. And then he says, here's this little baby who comes in humility and is, you know, not anything, you wouldn't assume anything when you saw him. But he's this King of Kings, the ruler, the Messiah, the Christ, the Anointed One. It's when you think about what's going on here. So after the Magi leave, Herod finds out, oh, he's been tricked by the Magi. So he goes and he says, I'm going to kill all the babies in Jerusalem. So he sends in Bethlehem. So he sends his army to Bethlehem, and they're killing the children that are Jesus' age. But Joseph was warmed in a dream, and he takes Jesus down to Egypt. What you see here is, in this passage, how it ends up is Joseph is in Egypt with Mary and the baby, and he's an angel comes to him in a dream and says, hey, the Herod's dead. You can go back. It's safe now. Do you see the contrast here of Herod's trying to kill Jesus, but at the end of the chapter, the one who ends up dead is Herod? Matthew's saying, look, the ones who are in power, Herod and Jerusalem, and it's this idea of what seems powerful to us, what we would expect, maybe for the Jews, what they would expect the Davidic king to be, this great ruler who's going to throw off Rome and who's going to establish the line of David as the king again. This great ruler, it's maybe not what you would expect, because Jesus comes, and he comes in Bethlehem. He comes in this little town, this insignificant place, and he is a little baby. And even as a little baby, the Magi are coming and worshiping him. And God protects him. God warns Joseph, takes him down to Egypt, and the threat, the one who is trying to kill him, is the one who ends up dead. A major point in this passage is God's providence in this plan. You know, we see it, we saw it starting in the genealogy, and we see it with all these dreams and how God's directing Mary and Joseph, and how God directs the Magi, how God sends the family to Egypt. We see God working in every part of this. God's providence is so clearly seen through this whole passage of he's bringing the salvation, he's bringing redemption to the whole world. Another point here in that Matthew kind of starts here and continues throughout his whole book is this point of insignificance, or maybe just less than what you would expect. We see later in Matthew when he says, Jesus says, you know what, let the little children come to me. And you know, his disciples are trying to keep the children away, you know, because they're like, oh, they're just kids, you know, get them away. But Jesus says, let these little ones come to me. Oddly enough, it's the same word, these little kids that are, you know, helpless. These are the ones that are coming and running to Jesus. At the end of the gospel, in chapter 21, Jesus says, whatever you do for the least of these, you're doing for me. And it's this theme that Matthew starts here, that the insignificant ones, the ones who were kind of pushed by the side, these people are actually really important. These are the people that I've come to save. And this is what Matthew is starting to communicate here. This idea of Bethlehem's a little place. Jesus came as a little baby. And even the people that are on the farthest outside, the most remote, they're the ones who Jesus came to save. We can see from the Magi that the rulers, the authorities, and the important people are included here. And we see from the circumstances that Jesus came in this humble way for all people, even the least. If you think about the passage in Luke, this is the one we're all so familiar with, where Jesus comes, the angels announce it, but who do they announce it to? Shepherds, right. These insignificant outcasts. And they're the ones who are there that very first night, and they come and worship. You think about Jesus coming in a manger, right? This little baby that's lying in a feeding trough because there was no room. Bethlehem's this little place, and they couldn't house everybody. And so here's Jesus in a stable in a manger. The kind of the most insignificant things. This is something that Matthew and Luke both communicate in different ways. Matthew's communicating it through, you are this sweet little child in this little place, this little insignificant town, but you're the King of Kings. You're the ruler. You're the Davidic King. You're the Messiah. Luke's communicating in, there's no room for you. You're in this manger. And as I was thinking about these passages and how they communicate the same thing so differently, that Jesus came in this humble way. I was thinking about Philippians 2, and where, it talks about, it's talking about Jesus, and it says, your attitude should be the same as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, listen to this, he being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself as a servant, right? He takes on the human form and humbles himself, taking on our flesh, humbles himself and becomes obedient to death, even death on the cross. You see, all these things are working together. This humility that Jesus comes with is the humility that leads him all the way to the cross. And he completes this redemption there on the cross, and in his resurrection brings new life. And he will come and return. He is the Davidic King. He will come and return and establish that millennial kingdom for 1,000 years. This kingdom where the Davidic throne will be reestablished. But we see in his first coming, his first advent, that he comes in humility, he comes to a little place, and he brings redemption to the whole world. Even the Gentiles, even the least, this is what Jesus brings. And you're saying, wow, that's great. What does this mean? So here's what we can take from this today. I just got a few points for application. Number one, just because someone or something is the least doesn't mean that it's not important. Everyone that lived in Jesus' day would maybe look at Bethlehem and say, oh, that's Bethlehem. There's a bunch of shepherds around it. It's this little place. It's not an important place. But you never know what God's doing there. God can be working in the most insignificant places and through the most insignificant people, but he could be doing something great there. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe you think you're in that place and you think your job isn't insignificant. Or, maybe it seems like God has called you to do something insignificant. And maybe you're like, oh, it's just these little things over and over again. We never really know how God is working all things together. The wise men didn't know all the other things that were going on with Jesus' birth. And the shepherds, they got that very first night. But they didn't know that Jesus was going to die on a cross. We never completely know how God is working in all these different situations. So even in the most insignificant things or in the most insignificant places, we ought to follow God completely. We ought to be serving him, even in the littlest things. maybe especially in the littlest things. Maybe it's easier sometimes to do big things and to say, oh, I see God's doing this and I'm going to participate. And, we have a church work day, right? Everybody comes and helps. It's easy to help and participate in that, but, maybe the littlest things on a Sunday morning when no one's watching or even knows, maybe it's because you don't even notice things. But maybe it's harder to serve, and it's harder to do the insignificant things because to us they probably look insignificant. They seem like little things. But in the smallest details, God is working. In the littlest things, God is working. And those are the kind of things that he's calling us to do. We see from Jesus his humility in being God. In his very nature, he's God. Equal with God. And it's something that we're not. But he takes on flesh and humbles himself and comes to die for us. We see this example of humility, and that's what Philippians is telling us in chapter 2. This example of humility, this is the way we ought to live. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus. I mean, Jesus knew before his birth what was going on, that he was going to be born into this insignificant family full of controversy, full of maybe everyone assuming this is an illegitimate child. Jesus knew that that's the situation he was going to be born into, in a manger, in an insignificant town, and the only people that are going to know the King of Kings is here are these shepherds. You know, Jesus knew what he was stepping into. He knew that Herod was going to find out the Messiah had been born and go kill all the children. And Jesus humbles himself to come for us. This is the attitude we ought to take as we serve and as we go. Jesus comes and brings a message of salvation. And we ought to be sharing that with the insignificant people, with the people who we don't expect to hear it, with the Irish American sinner, you know. We ought to be sharing this gospel with everyone. This is the message that Jesus brings. He brings this message of redemption and salvation, even the Irish, for all people. as we go, it's hard to share the gospel to communicate this great act that's gone on, and it's hard to serve. But as we go today, that's the challenge for us to humble ourselves, to share the good news of Christ's birth. You know, it's an easy thing to do this season. You take your neighbors a Christmas card, you bake them some cookies if you're good at baking, and you go next door, you take them over, and, you know, you say Merry Christmas, and, you know, it can be the simplest thing, just something of, you know, this is the time of year when I celebrate Christ's birth and the salvation that I have through Jesus, and I just wanted to share that joy with you in this little way. You know, that's something that we can do this season, to proclaim the salvation we have. As you go today, I want you to think about ways you can serve in insignificant ways, in ways that don't seem to be the big deal, but little ways where God might be working. Be looking for those ways, because if you're not looking, you're going to miss them. There are these tiny things. They're the Bethlehems. They're over here on the side, just kind of, you know, no one's taking much notice of it. Look for those ways where God is calling you to serve and where God is working. And look for opportunities to share the gift that we have this Christmas. As we sing these last couple songs, I want you to be thinking about those things. And we're going to sing of these, of this little baby who has come. And so I'm just going to ask you to sit and, you know, feel free to join along in singing, but consider how the humility that Jesus came with and how we can serve and share that message.